Hello and welcome to episode 20 of In The Mood For Podcast with Callum Reid, UltimateAddict.com and Pete Shepherd, InTheMoodForBlog.blog.co.uk.
Hi.
Hi. This is not a usual episode this week. We are in London. Well, I am in London.
Mm.
Shep's just back in the Midlands.
So. I was.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So this could be more lo-fi than we've become accustomed to. But we'll do our very best with what we've got.
Yeah. It might turn out good. I don't know.
We can live and dream.
Stuff's happened this week. I just want to mention Harris Savides died.
Mm.
Famous cinematographer, did Milk, Somewhere, Birth, among other things.
Yeah, some very quality stuff on the CV.
Indeed. What, do you want to give a shout out to Heather Watson?
I was going to, yes. I'm not sure. Is it the first since Jo Drury? The first British woman since Jo Drury to win a title?
Yeah, since 1988, I think.
Good grief, that's crazy. Well done, love. Yes, and we might get onto some more Watsons later. We'll see if we can squeeze that in.
Following on from last week.
Yes, we might have a new feature.
I'm going to try and be a little kinder.
Yes. So we're just going to run through the straight into the films this week. We're going to run through some of the stuff we saw at the London Film Festival. So what was the first day you saw anything on?
Friday.
Right, okay, so we're going day by day.
Right.
Okay. All I did on a Friday was get on a train and get some beers. So it's you're flying solo on this one.
Sounds like a good Friday to me.
It wasn't bad.
What I saw on Friday was Lawrence Anyways, the new film from Xavier Dolan.
Uh-huh.
Who did I Killed My Mother and Heartbeats.
Mm-hmm.
Which I haven't seen.
No, me neither.
No. So he's only 23. So...
Oh, I tell a lie. I saw the first 5 minutes of How I Killed My Mother and turned it off.
Okay.
Anyway.
I think it's just I Killed My Mother.
Whatever.
How I Met Your Mother. Right?
How I Directed Elizabeth Olsen. Anyway, more on that later.
So Lawrence Anyways' new film. It's about a guy in his 30s who's married... or in a relationship at least with a woman, and he decides that he's been living a lie and that he wants to have a sex change.
As you do.
So he tells her, she's understandably not pleased, but she kind of comes round, but they go through a lot of difficulties in the course of the film, and he encounters prejudice, etc.
Right. Is this funny? Please tell me this is funny.
It's not. It's.
Is it a serious treatise on the subject? Is it a serious treatise on the subject of transgender?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it lasts 2 hours and 40 minutes.
So a brilliant Friday night for you then.
Well, this wasn't the night, thankfully.
Okay. You had the night to recover.
Yeah. I did actually like it. The main guy is played by Melville Poupaud.
He's good.
Yes, and he's very dashing.
Mm.
I didn't stay for the Q&A, but I'm sure
yeah.
It was good.
I could think of worse ways that my life could pan out if I ended up looking like Melville Poupaud.
I actually looked at his IMDb and he's played like quite, I think, gay characters before.
Yes, he has, yeah. So... The Ozon film... is the main one from 2005, Time to Leave. He's super in that.
Yeah, so I don't know if he's in real life, but we can live and dream.
Again, yes.
And his kind of on-off relationship is with Suzanne Clément, mm-hmm. who I didn't know before, but she's tremendous in this. As I said, it's too long.
Right.
Way too long. It badly needs editing. You can tell it's by a young filmmaker, I think, because you get lots of... It's like there aren't a lot of really silent scenes. There's always something going on.
Right.
So you'll get like kind of music video kind of... There's like a 3-minute sequence where Fade to Grey plays over it. And it's like this scene at a kind of lavish party. And some of it's in slow motion, and it's like a montage.
So it's got no faith in the attention span of the audience.
No,
even though he's asking them to sit still for 2 hours and 40 minutes.
No, but I think that's part of his charm. The fact that he is a young filmmaker, I think that's quite good.
Right.
Because I think he will calm down eventually. Mm. So it's interesting to see him like this, but I think that's also why it's so long, and he doesn't want to cut stuff out.
Right.
So I would just say be brutal in the editing room, and maybe this would have been excellent, but it just gets too repetitive and long.
Right. Much like our average podcast.
And this one, if it continues like this.
Yes. Yeah. Shall we move on then? Because we've got a lot of Leeds ones, London ones to get through. Freudian slip there.
So I sat Saturday out.
Saturday. I was supposed to see A Few Hours of Spring.
Oh dear.
Yeah, and so I met up with Cal and had a bit of lunch and moseyed on down there and sat in the seat. And after about 15 minutes, a woman came and said that there were some technical problems. Bear with us, we're sorting it. They're upstairs working on it right now. And about 10 minutes later, the film starts and the scene before the title, there was no sound. And so I thought, that's what the problem was. They haven't quite fixed it. And then after the title cards came up, the sound was back on. And I thought, wonderful. And then what actually happened was the sound was back on, but the subtitles weren't. And this is obviously a digital print. Yeah. And obviously the digital print that they've uploaded wouldn't accept the subtitle track.
So was the subtitles ever on there?
I think what it is it must be you have the subtitles as a separate file. I mean, this is what happens when you if you ever download something, you have to download the subtitle file as well. But interesting aside, because a friend of mine who I was staying with works in a cinema down in London, and I actually know that the projectionist rang him up while this was happening and said, can you go and look at your projection and see if the thing at the back's supposed to be up or down? One little levers. So this is going back to that documentary I saw, The Last Projectionist. This is one of the massive. This would not happen if you had a normal print, because the subtitle track would be on the print, and if there was a problem, then the projectionist would be able to fix it because they'd have the experience. Whereas these guys don't actually. All they do is press a button and it uploads, and you press a button and it plays.
But maybe they wouldn't have been able to make the film.
Well, yeah. So it'd be much more expensive. Yeah. So they ran it in French. Said to anyone, if you can speak French, you can stay and watch it. If not, you can get a refund. So
you left.
I walked.
Yeah.
Well, no, because the first scene, they left it up for about 2 minutes. I think it was at a job centre. I know about 1 in 8 words in French. I only did it for 2 years at school. There was no way. I couldn't even tell what was going on. It was not going to happen. So that was a good start. So how was your Saturday cinematically? What else did you see there?
Nothing on Saturday.
Right.
On Sunday afternoon, I saw...
Oh, the cheese and wine, right, yeah.
Yeah, oh, did you see something on Saturday night? Oh, we're going to get onto that, right?
Oh, yes, I did, yeah. But that's our end film.
So Sunday afternoon, I saw Beyond the Hills, the new Christian Mungui film.
Mm-hmm.
Director of 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days.
Which we all love so much.
Which we do, some of us. So this is about... Well, it's about two friends who are girls, but there's been a little bit of kind of intimate history going on there.
Some sapphic underlying issues.
Yeah, in Romania. So one girl is now a nun, and the other girl has come from Germany to visit her with the intention of taking her back so they can both work together on a boat, like a cruise ship. But it doesn't work out that way because
so many jokes.
Doesn't work out that way because the girl who's now a nun has gone so completely into the religion that she doesn't want to leave anymore, and God is her main source of love, etc.
Oh, right. So she's not, like, rocking the Leviticus and thinking it's all sin, 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 or is she?
What? Is she thinking what's the sin?
I mean, is she thinking about the whole, like, intimate history. I'm making these like evil genius hand gestures at the moment when I'm saying this. So is she thinking that it's all wrong, or is she just thinking, okay, or is it just like a God is now my where I'm going to get my comfort from?
Yeah, well, she's trying to like absolve herself from any pleasures, and she right. just like just necessities that she needs. So anyway, this goes on for 2.5 hours.
Ugh.
The girl gets kind of more involved in the religious side. They're staying at this camp, and there's like a priest guy. There's like a mother superior.
It's the Sound of Music.
It's what?
It's the Sound of Music with the camera not moving.
It's not quite that upbeat.
Well, you said it was camp. Oh, it was in a camp. Oh, right.
So basically, the girl gets accused of being, I don't know, under the devil's, like, care or guidance, and
right.
it gets into a drama about that, but it gets really repetitive. I think I'm not an advocate of religion in any form. Especially not Orthodox religion, but I think it's really cynical and nasty about religion in a way you wouldn't expect from him, because I think he deals with the abortion subject with a little more class than this. And also the last shot of the film is really crass, a really crass metaphor for what he wants to say about how religion is hypocritical, etc. So I didn't like it.
Right, okay.
So, what did you see on Sunday?
I saw I Killed Time by Seeing on the Road, which we're talking about later.
Yeah.
And I saw on the night the British premiere of Iana, which nice. Is the Rampling Family Affair film, which is Charlotte Rampling starring. Her son, Barnaby Southcombe, wrote and directed the film. And this is a very slick, stylish, British crime thriller, which is about a divorced woman, Rampling, who starts speed dating. And after her first speed date, the guy who was her main suitor is dead. That guy's son is beaten up and is on the run from the police. Rampling woke up, and we don't really know what next to the dead body. We don't know what she was doing.
Sounds juicy.
And Gabriel Byrne turns up. He's like the DCI, and he was in the area when the call came in, and he bumps into Rampling at the bottom of the outside the elevator. And so then, obviously, because she's Charlotte Rampling and age-appropriate hotness, he becomes obsessed with her and starts and starts stalking her. And so, it's really beautifully shot, and it's all about. There's a lot of flashbacks to actually what happened that night, and so that's the basic setup of how it all goes down. For the most part, it's all about the style. And the atmosphere and the mood, and Rampling's good, Gabriel Byrne's good, but in the final reel, Rampling goes into overdrive, and she's absolutely stunning. Some of the best, if not the best, acting moments of her career are in this last.
Sort of like. When everything comes to a head.
Or... Yeah, but once all the drip feeding, all the backstories and flashbacks have unveiled themselves, she's amazing. There's a scene in Under the Sand, which is probably widely regarded to be her best performance, at least of the last 15 years. I suppose some people might argue the Night Porter, if you were going back into the 70s as well. And there's a scene in Under the Sand where she's at the morgue and it's just a shot of her face, and it's absolutely a brilliant moment. And there's something of that ilk where it is just a shot of her face at the end of this film, and she's even better than she was in Under the Sand. It's just she's not as good over the whole of it as she was in Under the Sand, but the high points are absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, the thing is, we're not doing preconceptions for these. I'm probably one of the biggest Charlotte Rampling fans out there.
Isn't a surprise.
No, either. I actively seek out a lot of her stuff, and she routinely makes top tens of mine at the end of the year. But in fairness, I rarely flat out rave. But I do think this is because of the high points, and because she's very good for the most part anyway. I think this is her best performance since Under the Sand. And nice. But the surprise is how well made this is, and it really isn't just all about her performance. It's a very well made film, and I really hope it gets a good distribution deal, because
it sounds like a lot more interest in a crime thriller than British films seems to have been churning out lately.
Like The Sweeney. That's what passes for it. Yeah, so I did ask her a question. Did ask a question at the Q&A. There were only four questions answered. My question was to Southcombe about the positioning of the flashbacks, because you're seeing it from. I didn't explain this very well. And I didn't really go into it in this detail. I just basically asked him how he went about the positioning. Was that from the source material? Or was it something he came up with? He looks at me blankly. And then once I said the word structure, I said basically the same thing again. And once I said the word structure, I think he got what I was talking about, and he did answer the question. But my sort of thing with it is, you see these flashbacks and you see a little bit more of what happened that night.
Yeah.
And when you finally see the end of what happened that night, it's not from her perspective. So once you know everything that happens that night through all the flashbacks, it's not from her perspective. It's cut, and then it's Gabriel Byrne waking up, who's the detective in charge of the case. I understand why that happened, because there are other reveals to be had after the fact. So you do kind of need to know it before the end. But I just do wonder about how he went about the cutting of it. And Rampling said that it was different on the page to how it evolved in the editing room, and she thinks it got more interesting in the editing room, and he can't remember this. He said he couldn't remember the story. He didn't know what she was talking about. So I might have created a mini family discussion point, at the very least, if not ruckus. Yes, but that was my last film.
Okay.
Done it.
I have one more.
Right.
And saw Like Someone in Love last night, Abbas Kiarostami film.
Great.
All in Chinese. Was it Chinese?
Actually,
I think it's Japanese. However, it's kind of a companion piece to Certified Copy. It's most of the action is about a conversation between this young girl who's kind of an escort in Tokyo and this old professor who hires her, but he doesn't really want sex. And it's a cross-generational exploration of romance, is what I would say.
Keeping in the theme with liberal arts for the end for this week.
Keeping in the theme with what?
Liberal arts, because
oh, right.
we'll get there.
Yeah. but it's to cut a long story short, it's the best film of the year for me.
Right.
It's probably not quite as good as Certified Copy, but on the same level.
Right. Good.
Yeah. Awesome.
Mm. Anyone famous, or is this Kiarostami doing his non-professional actor thing?
There's an actor called Denden. Who's in Cold Fish, the Sono film, who I know from that. There's nobody really famous, but the main guy is absolutely brilliant. Just get up his name.
Yeah.
It's Tadashi Okuno.
Right.
That's his name. And he's really good.
Okay.
All right.
So that's probably going to come out at some point because certified copy.
I think it might be next year, but.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think Keir Starmer's big enough name now to get at least an art house 3-day release somewhere near me.
If they can release Holy Motors, they can release this, right?
Well, let's not go there. the guy I was staying with, he works in film. Down there, he's a visual effects photographer, and we were talking about bad reviews, and we were saying how on this podcast 2 weeks ago, I put on the description how I wasn't happy, and we got our record number of views on my blog.
Yeah.
And then this week, last week, I actually put that I was giving out 4-star ratings like they were going out of fashion. And surprise, surprise, we're back to normal. So we were talking about bad reviews, and I said, you never really read aloud a rave. You kind of only really read aloud like when they're deliberately trying to pull it apart. And he said that, yeah, sometimes it can be entertaining, but then again, they also make me think, well, if you think you can do so well, why don't you try it?
Well,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, and when I do Slate stuff, I do at least try and say why I didn't like it and how I thought it could have been better. I very rarely just try and just lambast something for the sake of it. So let's not talk about Holy Motors because it's very tempting just to lambast for the sake of it.
We do realise that obviously there's a lot of interesting films and it's better to be interesting than to be... to make a Ron Howard film, for instance.
Yes, yeah. I mean, this is the thing Von Trier, I think I heard him say once that he doesn't mind if people hate his films because at least he gets a reaction. And that is one thing I don't actually mind about him. I think that's a good, refreshing attitude to have.
Yeah. All right, so in keeping with that, do you want to, shall we go through a few preconceptions about the films that are out this week?
Yeah, this week we've got On the Road, Barbara, Liberal Arts, Ruby Sparks and The Hunt. Which is the Thomas Vinterberg film, which we both saw at the London Film Festival. Yes. So it's not actually out yet, but it's our main one for this week.
It's out soon.
Yes, soon. December, I think. Early December. Or late November. Might be late November.
Yeah.
So On the Road, I like Walter Salles' films. Motorcycle Diaries, Central Station, even... some of the other ones. I even went to see a Daniela Thomas film at Venice a few years ago because he was her co-director, and then I realised within about 5 minutes that Walter Salles was the reason I liked Walter Salles and Daniela Thomas films, and I was stuck watching something I really wanted to walk out of. It was the worst film of the year. It's called In Solitaire, and the only reason I didn't walk was because I'd just travelled like hundreds and hundreds of miles to go to Venice, and I thought, I can't come all this way and then walk out of the first film.
Yeah.
So
we've all been there. Obligations.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd heard it got very mixed reviews, and didn't have any preconceptions about the original material. But I do like Sam Riley, and I do like Walter Salles, and it had Amy Adams in a small role, so I was going to see it. You?
I like Walter Salles too. Really love Motorcycle Diaries. Everything else he's done seems a little under that, but that's fine.
Barbara Nina Hoss. Nina Hoss. Oh, grief. I've tried to get Nina Hoss in. I've succeeded once in a random comment, and then another one got cut out in the editing, which had to get cut out because it was too much of a random digression.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we love Nina Hoss.
We do. Well, I've only seen her in Yella and this.
But still, it's enough. Yeah, Liberal Arts, I don't... like How I Met Your Mother, but I've only ever watched like about 4 episodes of it, so I've no really positive or negative things about Josh Radnor. Lizzie Olsen, obviously, she's Lizzie Olsen, so that's a plus. And that's about it, really.
Okay.
Ruby Sparks.
Ruby Sparks, yeah, you don't like Paul Dano. I'm not the biggest fan either. I never seen Zoe Kazan in anything.
Oh, you probably have, but in a small role. Yeah. Have you seen Me and Orson Welles?
Seen what?
Me and Orson Welles.
No.
The Zac Efron, Richard Linklater thing. Oh, right, she's in that. She's quite good in that. Well, maybe you haven't seen her in anything then. Well, wasn't she someone's... Wasn't the kids are all right? It's complicated. Was she Meryl's daughter in It's Complicated?
Oh, I don't know.
If that's true, that is such a shout. We're going to have to keep it in. Zoe Kazan, he's typing it in as we speak. Sorry, that just shows I'm actually not reading the IMDb page and pretending to be bad boy. It's complicated, yes. Revolutionary Road, she's the girl that Leo has a thing for at work. I'd forgotten about that. she's in a few things. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. The Hunt, I don't like Thomas Vinterberg particularly.
I've only seen Festen of his, and I really like that, and Ulrich Thompson was super in it, so him getting his hands on Mads, that was a big... I was expecting good things.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like Mads Mikkelsen, too. Can best actor, etc.
Yeah.
Okay, so shall we do On the Road?
Yeah, On the Road is an adaptation of the seminal, in inverted commas, Jack Kerouac book. It's widely held to be unfilmable, or was, because it's just stream of consciousness. The prose is stream of consciousness, and that's where a lot of the appeal stems from. The story is about a guy called Sal, who's a writer, and falls in with like a trendy bohemian crowd, and in particular gets introduced to a guy called Dean, who's played by Garrett Hedlund. Sal's played by Sam Riley, and Dean is one of the mad ones, who's the source person that Riley lives vicariously through. And yeah. So it's all about his life on the road, following him around, and then splitting off from him and coming back together, and how the Dean impacts on his life.
Indeed.
That wasn't too bad, actually, considering I thought it was going to be much more difficult to summarise than that.
It's much more direct than the film is, which is very sort of sprawling and vague and hard to get into, I think. And it's I
you
think
mean
it's pretty, it's,
intellectually it's, or emotionally? Or both?
Emotionally. I think it's very easy to get the social context of the film. The post-war kind of men trying to find themselves again, away from kind of physical responsibility or commitment. And it's sort of like a mini cultural revolution of the time, maybe.
Yeah, it's very underground, and I like what I liked about it. Well, one of the things I liked about it was that you have all this content, which, especially back when it's set in like late 40s, would be really shocking. It's less so now, but it still is surprising given the when it's actually set. There's threesomes, there's gay content, there's lewd acts, there's straight sex scenes as well. But I like that it's dealt with, because for these characters and for this sort of like subculture, it wouldn't necessarily be shocking for a guy to be quite openly gay or what have you within his group of friends. I like that there's never a big deal made about it, and there's a very accepting because that's how it would have been with those types of people.
Yeah.
So I did find a refreshing authenticity within that.
Yeah, definitely.
I might surprise you here. I quite like this.
I didn't dislike it.
But I quite like it's because what it's the cinematic experience. It just washed over me, and so because it's got the gorgeous cinematography and the music and what have you, but it's what I really liked writing a review on this. It really got me thinking. And what I was talking about in my blog review was it's all about these little moments that sort of surge up, and there's the best one is probably when Sal sat there at his typewriter. He's had all these experiences, and it just cuts to a shot of a road going off into the distance, and you realise that this is haunting him, and he's compelled, he's drawn to it, he can't get away from it.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the visual side of like of this that creates these moments. And then when Dunst throws out, she's married to Dean, Garrett Hedlund, and she throws him out and she starts packing for him and tells him to get out, and then he starts taking over the packing, and for about 2 seconds, look on her face, it's like the thought that he would do this has never entered, it was never a possibility. And it's like just him doing it is like a sucker punch, and then she hits the roof because she didn't expect him to do it.
Garrett Hedlund's character, Dean, is sort of the main character, really.
Yeah, there are discussions online about whether he's lead or supporting. I think in the film he's lead because it's very much about him told through Sal's eyes, and whenever he's not on screen or Sal's gone off his own, it's always informed by what Dean's doing, and it's very much the two together.
Yeah. I think their relationship or friendship is really touching and probably the best part about the film. There's a moment near the end where kind of he betrays him a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's not hugely surprising, but it's surprising enough to make you think.
Yeah.
And make you look at things from the perspective of Sal.
Mm.
Where before maybe it was a little bit more rounded in its view.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing with that is that throughout the film, every single person that Dean makes feel miserable, it's because they've got a dependency on him. And so all these people, they're throwing themselves at him, they want to like cage him and own him, and so he's like this restless like firecracker. Yeah. And he's always got to go off and do something different. And so it's interesting that that is the one point of time where Sal becomes really weak and dependent upon him, and that's when, and it's, so that is in character. That's when that happens.
I want to mention Kristen Stewart, I think, is good in this.
Yeah.
Kind of suffers when she's not in it.
I think there are certain, again, it's all moments. It's like when Garrett Hedlund tries to engineer a threesome with her and Sam Riley, and then the way both of them handle that, like he bursts into laughter and she's sort of like, you can tell she's not really into it, but then there's a lot of stuff going on under the surface, and it sort of bubbles up. I believe that more than some of the other things and the ways that it shuffles along. I think for me overall, the problem is that like when we say with the it just skates over too much, and there's too much of a gap between everything, which hurts the dramatic underpinning. Yeah. And if you had it all there, if you had that there, then the whole thing would be really, 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 really moving. But as it is, because it's so stripped down, and because it sort of shuffles, then jumps, then shuffles, then jumps, it kind of it is just going to be these like moments that just ebb and come up out of nowhere.
It would work so much better as a mini series.
Yes, yes, like Brideshead Revisited, because it's got that similar sort of like romantic friendship vibe to it.
Because for two hours 15 minutes, it gets repetitive with kind of Dean's relationships go back and forth, and it's got a lot of peripheral characters that don't really serve any purpose. I don't know why Amy Adams is trying to be in this.
Yeah, Vigo, Elizabeth Moss.
Vigo's on the poster.
Yeah, I know, it's hilarious. That is hilarious. I can't really stress enough though how much I did enjoy the experience of watching this. It's
very classic and literary.
It's so nice. And it's really seductive. And so I think, really, that if you're going to do this in that amount of time, then I don't think you can do a much better job than Walter Salles did with this film. Because some of the editing is just like gorgeous, how like cut into like the car going over a bridge, and it will like the visuals, the way the editing smooths out the visuals, which are gorgeous, and then that all intertwines in with a very well nicely drilled cast.
The direction's very nice.
Yeah, it's the screenplay. There's too many gaps. And
do
that,
you not think it's because the novel, I mean, they say it's unfilmable. I just think the novel should not, I don't think this film should be made. Pretty much. I just think it's too aloof for too long. It's the same over and over again. And I think it's a little bit difficult to care in parts. Because it's just,
yeah, especially about Dean when he's being a giss. It's just, you're like, get over it. Yeah. But, yeah. I did like the scenes with Alice Braga and Sam Riley when he's out doing the cotton picking at the beginning. I think that's probably Sam's best work in the film. And he is one of our better young actors.
He is. He's a little bit flat in this.
He's because he has this kind of like, it's not about him. It's more of like a Nora Jones in My Blue Green Nights thing. It's more about how the other characters reflect back, and you're just impressed I got the Wong mentioning. It's how the other, but you'll see what I mean. It's how the other characters reflect back on her, and it's the same here. It's how the other characters appear through his eyes that make also inform them more. So it's a nice performance, but he doesn't have much to do.
Yeah.
Hmm. Rating on this one?
A C+.
I'm a little bit more than you. Low 4 stars. I'm actually going to have to specify on this. 7 out of 10. You'll see why as the podcast progresses.
Okay.
Right. So, from that on to Germany's submission for the Oscars this year. Barbara. Yes.
Have you seen a German film this year? Because I haven't, apart from this.
Oh, have I? Yes, but not. This is hilarious. I've seen, I'm not sure if it's actually 2012, but I saw a film called Rubble Die Katz, which is basically a very commercial German riff on Tootsie, because it had Alexandra Maria Lara in it, and she like plays like the star, and then there's a guy who like can only get he can only get a job by pretending to be a woman, and in like this Hollywood film about Nazis. It's stupid, but there are some very funny moments in there. It's like how they're like thanking Hitler because without him they wouldn't have a German film industry.
That might be true.
I know. But anyway, yeah, I think that's the only one I remember seeing this calendar year at the very least. Yeah, so Barbara, it's about the GDR. It's about a doctor from Berlin who has submitted she's asked for permission to leave the country. So as punishment, she's been expelled to the Styx up in North Germany by the Baltic, I think. So she's working at this small little hospital in this small little town. And the guy who's like running the hospital is... what's his name? You can cut this. Ronald Zerfeld. And he's reporting. It's an open secret that he's reporting to the Stasi on her progress, and what have you.
Yeah.
So he's trying to not ingratiate himself, but make sure that she like tries to fit in and not be so aloof. And it all goes from there whilst she's still trying to get out of the country, and he's trying to get her to engage more with the local populace.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this was directed by Christian Petzold, who also did Yella, aforementioned Yella. And I think
there are no car crashes in this, thankfully.
No, not with all the Travises, but well, it's all bikes as well.
Yeah.
But Yella was very much for those who haven't seen it. It's quote. Famous, unquote, because Hoss beat Marion Cotillard in Le Mans at Berlin. And I think Yella was very much a Nina Hoss performance piece, and then the film wasn't as good as her. For me,
I'd go along with that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's not the case here. It's really well made. There's not a score, is there? I think it's only diegetic music.
I didn't notice a score.
And the sound design, it's all the wind just rustling along. It's such a gorgeous environment that this all goes down in. And
I saw this German film last year, Sleeping Sickness.
Right.
Or at least it was a German director, and it's kind of like this. Like, it doesn't seem so dependent on plot.
Mm.
It's kind of more studious with the character and the themes and kind of visual storytelling.
Yeah.
So I don't know if maybe the going German cinema is having a new wave or whatever, but if it is, then
bravo.
All the more power to it. Yeah.
Before we talk about Hoss, can we just have a word for Ronald Zerfeld? Because I just thought this was the most gorgeous little performance. And apparent Yeah, and apparently, because I told you before, I was watching, before we went to start recording, I watched the press conference from Berlin for this film, and he got asked, one woman asked him a question, and apparently, from that question, he's used to playing, this is the first time he's ever done a sensitive role, he's usually playing, like, hard guys, and relying on a very macho presence. And he's so lovely in this, and it's so, and there's not a single scene where he has anything like showy, or he has to like has any kind of big scene to do, but it's just such a good little performance.
He comes across quite suspicious at first because he's being quite forward towards her.
Oh yeah,
so, you know, it's kind of, you're not sure what to make of him.
Well, it's Nina Hoss. If she walked into your hospital and you were in the GDR, you'd probably be a bit forward too.
In the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, that doesn't happen every day.
Yeah, but I think
strike while the iron or the German is hot.
But the longer it goes on, you get a real kind of affection for him, I think.
Yeah, he's got a lovely screen presence. Lovely screen presence. That was the big surprise of the film for me, because I've not seen him in anything before. And
I'm not sure how her character goes about things with him eventually. Makes that much sense? I don't know.
Well, I think because she's got a lover who's trying to get from the West, who's trying to get her out.
Yeah.
And I think that the very important scene is when she's gone to see him in a hotel, and there's a girl who his mate's trying to get out as well in the other room, and they meet, and you see from that that the other guy is saying to the girl how much he loves her and how he wants to marry her and all this sort of thing. And this is what I love about this film, because the subtext is subtext. This isn't explained that. And the point is that she's not getting this from her guy. She's not getting the I want to marry you, all this sort of stuff. Although there's a physical relationship there, and he does offer to come and it could be there with her. But, I think the two things in the scene is she says how you can't be happy in the GDR, and he says, come and live with me, and you won't have to do anything, you'll just have to stay home. And, the first point, I think, is why it ends up working with Zerfeld for me on an emotional level, because it's not spelled out, and it is a little bit here, a little bit there, but he is showing her that it is possible to be happy, in the GDR.
Yeah.
And, what this guy is offering her is fundamentally, when he says, come over and you can just do nothing. Zerfeld treats her as an equal the whole way through the film.
Yeah.
And he's just saying, she doesn't want to just sit at home and do nothing.
Yeah. So she has a lot of contempt for him, it seems, at first. And a lot of contempt for being there.
You know,
maybe he's just like this little doctor in this quaint place and worthy of a time kind of thing.
And knowing that he's informing.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure about this political situation at the time.
Yeah, that's the one thing after the fact, where they take the film dramatically towards the end, he says dancing around the subject. I think that issue is kind of left open and not addressed in the slightest.
But she's in on the communist side, right? And
no,
the side is the Allies.
Well, no. What it is is that the Stasi is like the state police who are basically the arm of the communist She's trying to get to the West, so she's more what's the word I'm looking for? She's more
left wing.
The opposite of socialist.
Right-wing,
then. Well, not necessarily right-wing, but she wants to work. We want to live in a free society. That's...
But she's on the communist side of the border.
Yes.
What I mean.
Yes. That's oh, right. Mean. Yeah. I thought you'd fundamentally misunderstood the film then.
No, I don't mean the side. I meant the side of the border.
Yes.
Whatever, yes. Yeah.
This is all happening in East Berlin. So she's in Eastern Germany, the GDR. So, onto Hoss.
She's very, at first, well, it's a very kind of tense performance, like uptight performance.
Especially for the first act.
Yeah.
She's holding everything in. And then I like how it is drip fed, how the first time you see her smile is when she's talking with a patient. and nobody else is in the room.
Yeah.
And then there's a really nice scene when Zerfeld takes the bike to work so he can ride home with her, and you can actually see there's a few times on the way back where she's smiling, and so you can see, but it, then still in that scene she tells him no and leaves and leaves him hanging, but yeah. you can just see it's going a little bit further, it's turning a little bit more. I just, my only real problems with this film are kind of to do with the plotting. There's a subplot with a girl who's in a local work camp, and it's like she turns up at the blue at Nina Hoss's door, and like, how do you even know where she lived?
It's very convenient.
Yeah, and there is a big contrivance for the end as well, and it's
the end is contrived. There's no getting away from it, but
it's not the point.
Saying that she has a different mindset than she started out with.
Yeah, it's getting across the conflict that she's in general. General, it's the desire to actually lead a fulfilling life and do things that matter, or live a comfortable life. It's an interesting subject. I'm just going to drop a few Hoss. a few Hoss performances here. Yella, I think this is about on par with Yella, her performance in Yella.
I would say so. Maybe even a bit better, but
yeah,
on that level.
Yeah, she also did A Woman in Berlin, which she's fantastic in. Brutal, harrowing film, but only watch it on a Sunday if you're particularly in the mood. But she also did Die Weiße Maasai, it's 2005. She kills it. You can't get it in this country, so the only way to watch it is online. Stream it, so you're not actually downloading it. But
this is all in the last 7 years as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. So she is kind of the best European actress nobody's ever heard of, really. I mean,
yeah,
she's probably better. I mean, there are others that I could name who are very good, like Maria Bonavi, or Nina Hoss has probably got the most number of absolutely first rate performances, and this is just adding to that.
Yeah, it's awesome. Great. Four.
Yeah, it's a four. I want to give this 9 out of 10 5 stars, but I think it's just it's just me being a savage with the it's as high an 8 as I can give.
Well, actually, I'm giving it a B+.
Yeah,
it's
so quite the same.
A high B+. So it's the same. The same thing.
Yeah. Right, we'll skip through the next two then, which we'll, both we'll of us quickly. Only both of us only one of us has seen. My one was Liberal Arts, which if we'd have reviewed last week, then poor Emma Watson would have been even disparaged even more. it's this week. We're going to review it this week. Liberal Arts. It's written, directed, and I'm going to assume, and starring Josh Radnor. I'm not sure if he produced it or not. From How I Met Your Mother. It's about a guy who is in admissions in a university or college in New York. He gets an invitation from a former lecturer to attend his retirement due a liberal arts college in, I want to say, Ohio. I should have written this down.
Fine.
So he goes back, and then when he's there, he meets Elizabeth Olsen, and he's in his mid-30s. She's 19 years old, and they strike up a friendship, which turns into something more. Mildly concise. Mm. Amid the rambling.
So how is the acting then?
The acting, Radner's got a really nice screen presence. It's very easy. You can get on board with him very well. It's all very low key. Yes, it's all very low key. Richard Jenkins is said professor, who he goes back to see, and he's like, he does have a few like biggish scenes, and I did think they felt a tad forced, but he does what he can with them. Olsen, on paper, this is an okay role, and she gives a good performance. So this is what she does. She elevates whatever she gets given. If you give her absolutely nothing, if you give her nothing, she'll be okay. If you give her an okay role, she'll be good. If you give her a good role, she'll be really good. So and that seems to be her the way she goes about it. Alison Janney has a small role. She's fun, but
nice.
So for about 2/3 of this, I was loving this film. without a hint of irony.
Is there a twist?
Yes. To the point that it was giving me Before Sunrise-ish type vibe, to because it's a two-hander. It's about two people becoming more and more interested with each other. She demands that he writes. It's a little bit cutesy. Like, she gives him a mixtape of classical music and then asks him to write to her by hand. So then he's like listening to the music and getting his mind opened up to that, and so you've got like montages of like the letters being sent over a period of time, and that's how the relationship evolves before he eventually goes back there to see her again. And it's there's only really one false note in the first hour, and that's where they're walking around the campus and they go into like an old cinema, and she says, "I think we should hug." It's weird. There's no way you can. I mean, Lizzie Olsen's good. She's not that good. You can't make that moment work. It's shoddy writing. Then it comes to a dramatic twist. It's just a character reveal, and it's really uninteresting. And I think it would be so much better if they just didn't go there. And what that then means is you almost have. It's like he's trying to suck all of the romance out of it by where the characters go after that, and then it is making a point about him being too old for her, and she's saying it's not a problem for me. He's saying it is a problem for me, but I just think it's off-putting dramatically the way they go about this. The bonus though is Zac Efron. The kid is hysterical in this film. He's got like a glorified cameo of two or three scenes where he's playing this trippy guy wearing a beanie-ish hat. And he's spouting off all these like stoner type wisdom. And he was such a hoot. And he's in it for the first bit, and he's in it for a couple of scenes at the beginning. And even asks Lizzie Olsen out for Josh Radnor. And then he comes back in about half an hour, 45 minutes later, and I was just so pleased he'd come back. I never thought this would ever happen to me with Zac Efron.
Oh,
I was delighted that he was in another scene. I was like, yes, Zac Efron's back.
Unexpected.
I loved Zac Efron as well. I thought it's divisive. Wendy, I thought he was fundamentally miscast.
Right.
I really liked it. So I think it is a bit overall there are. It is a bit sexist because every woman either every woman in this film either wants to or does sleep with him.
And he's wrote it and directed.
Yes,
it.
Yeah. It that nags away, and then on top of that, where they take it is just it's a bit emotionally arctic. The final, which doesn't mesh up with the setup.
Okay.
So I think up until that hour, I would have given it. I was probably where I was with Barbara. Four stars. 8/10. Maybe if it goes well, we could push this up to a 9. But because the wheels kind of fall off a bit, I still give it so much goodwill for that first hour or so that I am going to still give it 4 stars. But it's as low a 4 stars as you can possibly get, and it's a very low 7/10.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So Ruby.
Meanwhile, I was seeing Ruby Sparks.
While I was seeing Barbara.
No, I saw this like.
You know, I mean for me, because I almost chose Paul Dano over Nina Hoss today.
Oh yeah.
Because I got the times just didn't match, and I forgot that Barbara was on, and I'd never forgive myself ever if I chose Paul Dano over Nina Hoss for anything.
That's lucky I messaged you.
Yes.
So Ruby Sparks is the new film from Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris.
Legends!
Yeah, little collab going on there. You don't often get kind of directors unless that the Coen brothers working together often.
Mm.
But they directed Little Miss Sunshine.
Lots of music videos.
Yes. So this is about Paul Noel's character is a author who's had one big hit, and he's kind of got writer's block.
I was just going to say, did Daniel Day-Lewis overshadow him in that too? Please go. Sorry, do go on.
Yeah, so he's got one big hit and he's got writer's block and he's having kind of dreams about this girl because he's recently split up with his girlfriend of 5 years. This girl, he's encouraged by his shrink to write about this girl. So he kind of writes this short novella, half novella, wakes up one morning and she has turned up in his kitchen. Doesn't even meet her out on the street. She's in his kitchen.
Right.
They're living together. They're in a relationship. And it's the girl that he's been writing about.
So
everything's true. If he can go back to his typewriter, type this girl, Ruby Sparks speaks in French all the time, and she would speak in French.
So does she think that he is the guy, if there's a male character, is there a male character in the book that he's in the thing that he's writing in, does she think that he's the male character? Or does she just think he's him?
I think it's just about her.
So she's like the character from this, and then... I get it. Yeah. She's the character from the thing that he's writing, and then it's how she is with him. Real. Okay. Yeah.
So that's Zoe Kazan, who plays her.
And wrote the film. And produced the film.
Yes.
And is married to Paul Dano in real life, poor girl.
Is she?
Yeah. I think they've got a kid together as well.
Wow.
So this is also why I have philosophical problems with the film, because obviously she's produced this, written it, and...
Well, she's written it pretty well, I'll give her that, and she's acted it even better, because she's really good in it.
I really like her as a performer.
Well, but I've got...
Is this what it takes to give him work? This is my big problem with it.
I don't know, because it's... Yeah, but he's got an affiliation with the directors too, so...
Yes.
Lovely little cozy circle going on.
That's the other thing. It's like, okay, you guys actually like him. You're one of the few people who are actually casting. Don't think he sucks. Here's this film. Will you do it, please? Give him some work. So she's good. How's he?
He's fine. Yeah, he's pretty good. Because he comes across quite young before, but he seems sort of like lived a little bit in this.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's experienced with his writing, etc. Essentially, it's kind of a fable. I mean, Kazan, going back to Kazan, I don't like Zoe Deschanel at all.
Well, who does?
She annoys me to death.
Apart from hipsters, who does?
And Kazan's kind of like that in tone, but she's just so much warmer.
Yeah, she's got soul, Zoe can just be... Deschanel can just be vacant.
Mm. Yeah. So, it's essentially the film's a fable about how you're never ever going to find the perfect partner.
Right.
There'll never be a dream woman. It's kind of like relationships, you have to work on them, etc., etc., which I think is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes through the fable very well. The ending's too tidy for me.
Right. Too workshopped.
A little bit 500 Days of Summer-ish.
Okay.
But the supporting cast...
I was going to say, how's Chris Messina? Because I never liked him in anything, and I saw A Giant Mechanical Man recently. The first thing I ever really liked him in. He's playing the brother in this, the trailer tells me.
He's playing the brother who's quite kind of... you think he's a little bit shallow, but he gets better as it goes on. And he's pretty good. Annette Bening is Paul Dano's mother, who's married to Antonio Banderas, who is this kind of weird hippie guy, like eco warrior. They live in a treehouse. Well,
do they drive a Prius?
What?
Do they drive a Prius?
I don't think they drive anything.
Oh, right.
Okay. Against that. Steve Coogan's in this as his agent. Elliot Gould is his shrink. So it's pretty kind of stacked with the actors, and I liked it. I just think it's pretty easy to see where it's going, and
right.
The ending's a little bit disappointing, but generally I'd probably give this a low B, high B minus. I haven't decided yet.
Okay. It looks cute. I'm going to see it this week.
Yeah. It's definitely not offensive, I don't think. Like, it could be seen as misogynistic, she wrote it.
Yeah. I've heard it described as weird science from the female perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good way to describe it.
Mm. So,
let's get on to child abuse.
Oh, we're all over it. Because it's in... Well, it's topical. Child abuse this week. Good grief.
Yes. The Jim all...
Yeah. Let's not go there. Yes. Oh, God.
A little bit distasteful.
Yeah. So...
like this film. Hope it will cancel that.
So
this is the latest from Thomas Vinterberg, director of Festin / The Celebration,
mm-hmm.
which was also about child abuse.
Yes.
In a completely different way,
mm-hmm.
and better way. But so this is starring Mads Mikkelsen, was at Cannes, he won Best Actor, and he is Lucas, this kindergarten teacher, who kind of we see developing a relationship in the early days of the film, and he's kind of has a rapport with the kids. This little girl called Clara develops kind of a little bit of a mini crush on him, even though she's like six mm-hmm. or seven, and he kind of quashes that straight away, which in a roundabout way leads her to accuse him of, or not necessarily accuse, but to kind of make up this rambled sentence about how he showed her his bits or whatever, and tells the boss of the kindergarten school, and it kind of snowballs from there, and she tells the parents, and everybody in the community turns against him, pretty much.
90%, yeah.
Mm.
Mm.
I think, like, if you expect a film with this subject matter directed by a director from the Dogma movie, it's not exactly going to be subtle.
No.
I think it has less problems than I thought it would have.
I think it's a strange one, because I think some aspects are handled quite delicately, and I think others are extremely heavy-handed.
Yeah.
More with how with the reactions to Mads the later on it goes. I think with the girl, it's kind of like it's a Chinese whispers thing. She doesn't actually say that he exposed himself. She just says that he has a willy, and that it's like a rod, and that's why she doesn't like him. And so the teacher then takes that to mean that he's shown it to her, and then so from there.
Even though she supposedly likes him at the beginning, well enough,
and then she
calls somebody else in,
and then each time it changes or gets added to a little bit more or what have you, and it is very much the adults are driving the car on this one, because it's like as soon as there's a tiny little flag that they've got an end point that they're assuming, and then they almost like try and get them there. But at one point, the girl tries to backtrack on her story, and her mum like says no. And she explains to her why it's that it's good that she originally spoke out, and so that
which is crap, basically, because I see what they're trying to say with the whole people would rather see the worst in other people than the best.
Mm.
But when your kid's being like
potentially abused,
are you going to want to see? Are all of these parents going to want to see abuse? Like
no.
This has happened? Would there not be an element of denial?
Well, the my problem, and I do like the film in general. I do think it's good in general, but my problem is I don't buy some of the characterization. It's like they more than one person says that she's got the little girl's got a very vivid imagination, right? But then the dad says, who's Lucas's best friend, she never lies.
Yeah.
Well, how do those two things really stand up? They don't, quite frankly. Because if you've got a vivid imagination, you're just making up a load of stuff. That doesn't fit with somebody who never lies, and the whole point is that and the woman who's the boss at school says kids never lie. Well, you've been saying she's got a bit vivid imagination, so why are you saying that if she never lies? So
it doesn't shed the doubt that the parents have enough for me.
No.
It's too black and white, it's too instantaneous.
But
the dramatic escalation of what happens, there's two particular things that really bothered me.
I'm nodding here, by the way.
The supermarket scene.
Yes.
In particular, which is one probably the worst scene I've seen in the film this year. And
the dog
later on.
The dog. Yeah. Well, this is my other thing. Vinterberg was there. I didn't stay for the Q&A. He was there with his little girls, actually. His daughters.
Oh, God.
And before he said that this was an international problem and that the material was taken from, he says it's not just a Danish thing, the material was taken from international cases. And I'm sure it was. And every single scene in there rings true to a certain degree towards me, in that I can believe that that is how locals would react to somebody accused of this type of crime. However, the way that it's presented within this film, I don't buy it as a dramatic arc. I think it's piled on too much, and I think it feels like Vinterberg's trying to amp it up for Mads Mikkelsen's character, Lucas, rather than feeling like a natural progression of this is how it's gone. It is, it's almost like he's cherry-picking like the worst things that they could do.
Yeah, it's manipulative in that way, yeah.
But Mads, whenever he's confronted with somebody who is shows suspicion, Mads is brilliant. The dignity combined with the disbelief combined with the frustration, it's all dancing across his face, and it's the sort of role that if Greg Peck was around today, he'd be doing. I think he'd be doing something like this, because it's almost that he's like the gold standard for dignity.
Some guy get nominated in the '60s? Was it Stuart Whitman?
Oh, I didn't see.
For playing a child molester.
I didn't see that film.
But I think, I do think it, sidesteps some potential problems. I like the very end where he carries her over the floor.
Well,
that's a lovely way to kind of resolve things.
The very, very end, though, I do have problems with. I just think there are much more subtle and more interesting ways you could get the point across. Like you were saying, it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, if you'd have had somebody seeing that scene, because nobody sees that scene, and I was waiting, I kept on waiting when he carries her across, I was waiting for somebody to walk in. And I think that would do exactly the same that the last scene does. It would do exactly the same thing. It would show you it's never going away.
If it was the first scene, it might have had somebody walking in, and that's maybe the problem. I mean, it's very things happen kind of at the will of the director, but the very end, it's kind of obvious halfway through where they're going with the metaphor. It's pretty simple and kind of stupid, really.
Yeah,
it's like a witch hunt.
It is a witch. Witch hunt. It's it is Chinese whispers combined with witches of Salem, especially with the kids all saying all end up saying the same thing. I really like the boy playing Mikkelsen's son. I think when he was getting in his face, you can overact that. Dano.
I didn't like that scene particularly.
But I mean, in general, there were scenes where he could have gone over the top and he doesn't, and even when he's pushed big, I still bought him as the character and it being believable. I think some of the cinematography is lovely. The score is great. Gets a really nice mood. It's as far away from Dogma as I think he'll get. In that respect, because he's doing all the things you're not supposed to,
make a pretty film.
yeah. And I think without Mads, I wonder how much goodwill I'd give this.
I think it could really have been terribly overdone by an actor, but I don't think it's a great feat of acting itself, because it's a lot about the decline of the actual character and a lot about projection. I don't think he's that good himself. He's fine, but I just don't see this as a best actor thing at all.
I think that it's the high point. I think it's kind of like I was saying with Rampling earlier, how she's like, there's a certain level, and then at the end she goes into overdrive. And I think with Mikkelsen, it is more, he's on a certain level, and then when those moments come when people start doubting him, that's where he kicks it up, and that's where he gets the best actor type praise from, and then it settles back down. Yes.
So is this his Dancer in the Dark? Is it kind of about kind of damning people for kind of persecuting somebody based on their own prejudices, or?
I think it's just, this is a type of subject matter that interests him, obviously, because he's dealt with it before, differently, but before, and it's just a different way of dealing with the same, with this, a different take on a similar subject matter. And it is, oh yeah, it's topical, it's relevant, it is important, in inverted commas. And this is where you get to the word pretentious. I'm not sure I think it's pretentious, but I could see why somebody might think it is, because if you're claiming this great importance through the subject matter and you're treating it in this way where it is, I don't want to say sensationalised, but certainly amped up.
I would say it's sensationalised. Mm. It's always topical, or love's always topical.
Mm.
This is always going to be topical.
Yeah, it's always going to happen. Unfortunately, yeah. It's always going to happen. And it's always going to happen everywhere in the world.
Yeah, but I don't think this says anything about...
I don't think there's anything new here?
Well, I don't think there's anything new. I actually think Hollyoaks did this story a lot better. A couple of years.
That's like me with Citizen Kane. It. So me saying The Simpsons did Citizen Kane better than Citizen Kane.
It really did. It really did do it better. But it's not. I get what it's saying about insecure communities. Are very quick to jump on a bandwagon. It just lays out all of the components that lead them to this, like really brazenly and in a way that I don't think works.
Yeah, some of it's too neat as well. Like his girlfriend works at the place, so she gets all the insider stuff. She gets extra doubts from there, and she's seen him with the kids and all this sort of stuff. It is a little bit,
yeah,
a little bit neat. But so rating for me, I'm giving it, again, it's not just a 4-star for every single film. Has been 4 stars this week, but again, low 4 stars, 7 out of 10, because I do have a lot of issues with the screenplay, but I think it's very well made, and I did really, really like Mads.
I'm giving it a C-.
Okay. Because you had more issues and didn't particularly really, really like Mads.
Yeah, pretty much.
which is understandable. Right. So the initial thought process to end this was top 3 performances by Bond villains in honour of Mads. So we're not actually going to do that in great detail, but I'm just going to shout them out now. Max in Passion of Anna, I'll have a Price and Regeneration, and Bardem in The Scene Side, and we'll move on.
I had Rosamund Pike in An Education.
brilliant. Yes.
But that might be quite a spoiler, actually. But well, it's like 10 years old, so yeah. Something.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so Shag, Marry, Kill.
Yeah.
Which is going to be very difficult for me this week.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Everything's 4 stars. Right, so Shag, which is the cinematic equivalent of You'd Watch It Again Tonight, if you could.
Yes.
So I'm going to go for Ayanna.
Okay, I'm going to go for... Is this including festival?
Yes.
Or is this, yeah.
Yes, including festivals.
Like Someone in Love.
Right.
Marry?
Marry, which is you'd watch every weekend for the rest of your life. I'd go Barbara, I think.
Yeah, I'll go Barbara too.
Mm. I can think of worse ways to spend 105 minutes. And then Kill, which is burn every single cinematic negative of so it doesn't exist anymore.
Bye bye, Mads.
Mads is gone. Well, yeah, I'm here, I'm sort of thinking...
Do you just want to kill the last third of liberal arts?
I do really want to kill the last third of liberal arts. I kind of want to kill a little bit of On the Road, because for not being as good as it could have been.
Yeah, just wipe the slate clean and let them do a series.
And I am tempted to kill The Hunt because it's just a bit forced. Well, very forced. Yeah. It's going to be liberal arts because it is really the antithesis of my romantic sensibilities. Yeah. So, in that respect, it's offensive to me.
Well, you did say it was the lowest four star you can get, so
yeah,
it must
yeah.
be your least favourite of the week, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that'll do it. So, the Watson factor this week, in honour of last week, where it was meant to show how many ridiculously good-looking women there were last week, that even somebody as pretty as Emma Watson was, like, the fifth best-looking woman on show last week. Mm-hmm. So the Watson factor is going to be a number.
Okay. Are we including the films that I saw? Because the Beyond the Hills girls are not up to scratch.
So okay.
We're all right there.
Right. So the Watson factor is a number from one to anything, which is where she would be. It's to show the relative ridiculousness of the attractiveness of the leading ladies. I think this week we've got a Watson factor of 2 because Lizzie Olsen is around. And Barbara Hoss, well, extremely becoming.
Barbara Hoss.
Barbara Hoss, yes. Oh, dear, that's classic. Nina Hoss. Well, she was Barbara in the film. Nina Hoss.
Yeah, I think Emma Watson's prettier.
Prettier, yeah. Although Hayley Atwell was in Iana. And also, if we consider that liberal arts really was last week, then we'd have a Watson factor of 1.
We would. Should get there one day.
Yes. But if we ever break 5 on the Watson factor, then I think that'll be the apocalypse. It will just be, we've got to give some normal looking women roles if we ever break 5 on the Watson factor.
True.
Although, to be fair, if I'm going to be nice and say, Lizzie Olsen was really last week, then the Maria Kirilenko lookalike who served me a beer before Iana, if she counts, then we've got Watson then we've got a Watson factor of 3.
Was that at the cinema?
It was at the pub next to the cinema.
Oh, right. Which cinema?
It was in Mayfair.
Oh, I went there too, probably.
Yeah, Maria Kirilenko's twin. Barmaids do not look like that in Birmingham.
Okay. We have a blog. It's moveforpodcast.blogspot.com. We have a Twitter at moveforpodcast. We're on iTunes. We're on Facebook.
Feedburner.
Mm-hmm. Next week? If you've got any questions for next week,
yeah,
comment on the Facebook page. Or
I promise I'll hate something next week, because that's apparently all that people want.
Well, what is next week? Because then, Beast of the Southern Wild.
Oh, didn't like the trailer for that.
Preconception.
It's possible. Okay, we're looking.
Ginger and Rosa?
Is that even coming out? I don't. Well, I'll just shove up Cineworld now. I that looks like the sort of thing that's only going to be out in London. But here we go. Led Zeppelin, don't think I'm seeing Celebration Day.
I do like Led Zeppelin, actually. Just don't want to see a film about them.
Frank and Weenie.
Ugh. Can we just draw a line under Tim Burton or something? Madagascar 3. Noah Baumbach.
What?
Yep. Paranormal Activity 4.
Oh, here we go. If enough people reply, then I will go and watch Student of the Year, which is the Bollywood film I mentioned the other week that had the most awful trailer. And that looked absolutely atrocious. If we get people replying, I will go and see Student of the Year for your pleasure, because there's I encourage people to go on YouTube and try and find a trailer with English subtitles, because this thing looks hideous.
Yikes. apparently there's a film next Monday coming out with Halle Berry and Olivia Martinez, who are actually going out now.
Oh, right.
Called see, Dark Tide.
See, Olivia Martinez, we didn't mention the other week. That's probably why Kylie knows a little bit of French. She's got
No, let's assume she was more cultured before she met that sleaze. Please give the girl a little bit more credit.
What, Mick Hutchins? Didn't she join the Mile High Club with him? I'm sure she did. I heard her talking about that. Maybe that's why she liked Martinez. She wanted more of the same. I'm standing here with you. I want you more. Even if it throws you to the fire, fire, fire.